My guest today on the program is Professor Steve Jordans. Professor Jordans is a professor of psychology at the University of Toronto in Scarborough, where he specializes in human consciousness, memory, and attention. Professor Jordans was a top 10 finalist in TV Ontario's 2007 Best Lecturer campaign, in which he spoke on critical thinking, or perhaps the lack of critical thinking, particularly in regards to our food system and academia and other walks of life as well. So I've invited him on the program today to share some of those insights. So first, Professor Jordan, I'd just like to thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to speak to me today.
Thanks for the invitation.
No problem. All right, so I guess we could just jump right in. First, Professor, I just wanted to ask you some of your thoughts on critical thinking and what exactly it is, because at university we hear a lot about critical thinking and critically engaging with the material, but at the beginning of your lecture you seem to sort of lament the fact that it's difficult to actually encourage students to think critically, and students who come into university don't have those skills. Can you speak about what those skills are and how that exactly manifests?
Sure, and I may do so a little bit in terms of what it isn't as well. But, you know, critical thinking I see as really coming to a position on something, let's call it opinion formation, I guess, but a position that's really based on seeing the issue from a number of different perspectives, seeing any hard data there may be that's to bear on it, and essentially, you know, a rational process of coming to some opinion in an informed way, as opposed to, for example, accepting an opinion because it's a common opinion or it's what people you know and like believe. So indoctrination would be kind of the opposite, where indoctrination is just if you're within some sort of context and there's a view that's very common within that context, then you may just come to accept that view without much of that rational thought. And so, yeah, I argue that for a lot of our intro students, when they come into university, most of the opinions they have were formed more on the basis of indoctrination, and that this sort of rational critical thinking could actually be quite new to them.
Wow, okay. So what do you think are some of the barriers to critical thinking? Is it just a matter of indoctrination and the peers, or is there a psychological element that sort of prevents them from thinking critically?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is, there's a number of levels. One thing is that critical thought, real, you know, quality critical thought is time-consuming. It's effortful. It requires people to actually spend some serious time, not only in sort of learning about things, but also in learning how to voice their opinion on it in a clear way that they think represents their knowledge, and then being open and willing to listening to other perspectives and bringing that back into the thought process and being willing to change one's opinion. And so I think there's all sorts of barriers along the way. And in cases of indoctrination where a certain viewpoint is very, very common, then it's very easy to just accept that viewpoint and not engage in all that effortful processing. So the effort is kind of the first step. Mm-hmm. But there also seems to be a real resistance towards any desire to change an opinion in the first place. So it seems like when we do put in the effort and when we do come to an opinion on something, for many of us, it's kind of, there seems to be this notion like, I did my work, here's where I am, and I voiced that opinion, and that is now my opinion. And there seems to be a resistance, and sometimes a very active resistance, to encounter information that doesn't fit with that. And so those were some of the blockages I was talking about, some of the psychological processes we know about, which you know, one really good example is confirmation bias. There are all sorts of things. If you have two university teams playing and you ask students at the respective universities to look at the game and to talk about which team is more dirty and which one's creating, you know, producing more fouls and such, they will almost always, if not always, think that the opposing team is the much dirtier, nastier team, and they will see everything that looks like a foul that that team commits, but they will not do it for their own team. So it really seems like they're on the lookout for stuff that fits with what they want to believe and actively ignoring things that doesn't.
Yeah, I've heard about studies regarding just that after a game when you ask athletes what was the major contributing force. Was it the referees or was it their determination? It always tends to be them if they win and the referees if they lose or that sort of thing. But I'm wondering, what role do you think university has to play? What do you think works at university in encouraging critical thinking? What do you think maybe doesn't work so much?
Yeah, okay, so that was the real kind of tricky meat of the thing, because really the way I view critical thinking is much similar to how you would view any skill, even something like learning to swing a bat in a baseball game if you've never played baseball before. The first few times you do it, you're not going to look very graceful, and you're not going to be very effective in terms of hitting the ball. But you really need to get a lot of practice doing it over and over and over. So, you know, my first perhaps somewhat strong claim is that most of the students who come into our classrooms have not had yet much practice, and definitely not much formal practice where they've been given feedback and that sort of thing. And so first and foremost, that's what I think we need to be doing more of in the university context, is literally not just downloading knowledge to our students, which I think we do quite well, but we really have to be sure we augment that with some sorts of exercises that push this notion of critical thinking and that encourage this idea that opinion formation is a recursive process that should continue to develop and never be seen as over.
Okay. So maybe we could just put some examples to that. In your lecture, you spoke about a historical example of slavery, and you analyzed critically some of the arguments for and against slavery and how a lot of people came to hold those arguments. Can you maybe just go through what the arguments for slavery are?
Sure. There's a monster book by a guy named Drescher on slavery that really, when I read it, it's a tome. When I read it, it opened my eyes in a number of ways, and one of them was just this point out that literally slavery is super common, and that the example we think of the African Americans in the southern part of the states may be perhaps the most recent and salient version, but literally almost every peoples on the planet have taken every other peoples on the planet as slaves for a variety of reasons, sometimes even enslaving their own citizens. And in many cases in history, the notion was that there was nothing unnatural about this, that human lives came in different levels, I guess you'd call it, castes, whatnot. And if somebody, for example, was foolish enough to attack our country and was captured as a prisoner of war, they are now a slave and all their children are slaves and they are born slaves, and that just provides a sort of hierarchical structure to society that allows it to function well. So there was a view that, you know, this is really a good thing. This is how society should be. People should occupy different levels, castes, and that makes for a really efficient, well-organized society. If we think of the American example more specifically, and a lot of the slavery occurring around that time, a major driving force was economics, in the sense that a very cheap labor force made a country economically very powerful. And so, you know, it's a much more kind of practical level, I guess, at which the argument was made. But many people saw slavery as a good thing that way, and I think psychologically justified it via arguments that saying that whoever the enslaved class was, they weren't quite the same level of human anyway. And so it was justifiable that they might not have the same amount of rights and such that the real humans have.
Yeah. Well, slavery it's a fortunate example for us today. Obviously, it's an ugly historical example, but it is something that we've obviously all come, or the vast majority of us have come to change our minds on, and we obviously don't have slavery, not to the same level as we do as we did before. So I'm wondering, how did we come to change our minds? How did we come to think critically about that issue?
Yeah, that's in the talk I gave, one of the points I like to make almost as a contrast is I talked about William James' view of how opinions should change. And his basic view is interesting, if not completely accurate, at least for first-year students. His view is that the way you bring about change in thought in these sort of situations is to show people that certain beliefs they have really shouldn't coexist, that they conflict with one another, and that it doesn't make sense to hold views that are really contradictory, And therefore, if you do and you do an analysis, you may want to change some of your opinions so that you're actually sort of ethically have a consistent stance.
Mm-hmm.
So in the case of slavery, that was the original attempt by a lot of the abolitionists in the sense of the Declaration of Independence, where, you know, the famous line of it says that, you know, everyone's entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that all men are created equal, of course. And so the abolitionists are saying, well, you know, hey, these all people are created equal. That means a slave should be considered equal to anybody else, and slavery kind of goes against that, and it certainly seems to go against liberty and the pursuit of happiness. And that was a time when, in America at least, the Declaration of Independence was huge because they saw themselves as, ironically, kind of enslaved to England, and they wouldn't have it anymore, and they wanted to insist on it, and the Declaration of Independence was their, you know, rallying cry of a sort and their flag. And so at one level, you would think it would have been enough to say, listen, if that's what you really believe, if that's what you want to define your country of as, then this practice of slavery just doesn't fit. And so one of them's got to go. But, you know, the ironic thing, of course, is not the ironic thing, but the informative thing really is that that wasn't enough. A lot of people making those arguments were literally lynched, or their presses were burned. Eventually, it came down to a civil war, with the North winning, to really abolish slavery. And so the sort of cognitive level of analysis is often not enough to create change. But in James' point of view, for the really strong thinkers, that should be enough. And that should be the process that we're kind of shooting for.
Yeah. Okay, so in that case, it wasn't so much a win for critical thinking as it was for just sheer brute force on one side over the other.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, you'd like to think that, you know, critical thinking was the fuel of some sort. That was the impetus that got people, I guess, upset enough to take it to physical force. But it did seem, at least with respect to that issue, that alone was insufficient, and that, yeah, you did need some sort of brute force to back it up.
So you made a rather provocative juxtaposition, if I could say, between those arguments for and against slavery to the arguments for and against meat consumption. Obviously, meat consumption is not an issue where we'll have a civil war about it. It's hopefully not. So can you first speak to some of those arguments, and what are the arguments for meat consumption, and what do you see as the problems to those arguments, and how we should reevaluate them?
Sure. Yeah. So first of all, I did that just as an interesting side point, as an attempt, I guess, to be clever in terms of so much of the talk was trying to convince people that, hey, we have these defenses, and they're engaged all the time, and you might not even know when you're blocking out certain information or you don't want to think about information. And sometimes these defenses can be extreme. So the kind of nasty trick, I guess, I tried to play on the audience was to seduce them with the slavery argument, whereby most of them are on the side that kind of won, I guess you could say. So the people living with slavery at the time in the South, they probably didn't think there was anything wrong with it, but most people now do. And so it was quite easy for them to look and say, yeah, I can see how those people were fooling themselves and et cetera. And so then the goal was, okay, now let me twist it and put you on the other side of a very similar debate, because most of the audience does continue to eat meat. And I really wanted to point out that if you bring in these issues of critical thinking, it really turns into a very similar, if not even stronger, issue on some level. Because you now, when it comes back to that sort of William James analysis of inconsistent views, there's all sorts of data now that suggests that, especially factory farming, and I really want to aim that, and I don't know if I was clear enough about that in the talk. There's a practice called factory farming, and if anybody doesn't know it, they should go to YouTube and type meet your meat,
absolutely.
And they will see it graphically, and it's really the way the vast majority of our meat is produced now. And you know, I was trying very hard in the talk not to make it an emotional talk, but to keep it intellectual. But part of the intellectual argument is that, you know, most of us do not believe in intentionally causing pain and suffering to other life forms. But if you watch that video, you will see that's exactly what factory farming is doing. So that was kind of like strike one. If you're not a fan of pain and torture and inflicting it, and you believe that strongly, well, eating meat conflicts with that. The one that I think is almost most informative, there's a few of these different strikes, is the environmental strike, because mm-hmm. So many people have seen an inconvenient truth, and that's how we think of the global warming issue, that we have all these emissions coming from factories and from cars and from planes and from trains, and in fact, that's about as far as Al Gore took it in a lot of that stuff. But it turns out that the biggest contributor, thing that's contributing to greenhouse gases in the environment is the emissions that come from factory farm practices. And in some ways, you know, giving up eating meat would be a heck of a lot easier than giving up burning fossil fuels. And it turns out that those emissions, in fact, are greater than the combination of all forms of transportation on the planet. So if we combine cars, planes, trains all together, look at how much emissions they're causing to greenhouse gas, it's less than the emissions caused by factory farming. So what's fascinating about this is that is how seldom you hear it, how often you can turn on CNN and see talks about global warming, environmental change, increasing gas mileage standards on cars, things that really would have very small impacts relative to if we all stopped eating factory farm meat. That would be the biggest thing we could all do, and it's not talked about. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a really powerful example of how not just individuals, but in fact, whole media operations can ignore or avoid information that is uncomfortable. And it's uncomfortable because not eating meat requires a big behavioral change. Yeah. So there's another list of things that I gave in the talk, but those are the two that I think are most powerful.
So do you feel this is an evidence of indoctrination part of the media on not speaking to some of those arguments against eating meat?
Yeah, I mean, it's at the indoctrination level, the meat-eating one is really nice as a current example, because for almost all of us, and definitely myself included, we grew up in a family context where our parents thought meat, potatoes, and vegetables was the right, the healthy, the appropriate meal. And so most of us, and definitely myself, probably had, you know, 5 to 7 meat every evening of the week. We'd have meat of some form on the table. And so as a form of indoctrination, you can't get much more ubiquitous than that. It's just everywhere, and the people we love most all do it. And so it's a very, very common thing. And when you combine that then with, yeah, things like media not highlighting stuff like that, then it becomes, you know, indoctrination at even a greater level. And on the meat-eating issue, you know, it really is everywhere, the indoctrination. And so for many people, when they hear some of these arguments, if they take the time to hear them and listen to them, it really is a bit of an eye-opener, and it really is strange. And for me, I'm 44 now, and it's really only been in about the last 2 or 3 years when I really started looking into this and started, you know, realizing, geez, I can't continue to do this. But it took, you know, that long for me as someone who values critical thinking and has mm-hmm. been pushing it for years to come to that realization.
So you had your William James moment.
Yeah, in one of my head, which again was, you know, the funny thing is when you have all these defenses, how do you pry past them? And for me, I mean, it just happens. I think the answer might be different for different people, but for me, it came in the book called The Philosopher and the Wolf, where the book was already about two things I love, which was dogs. It was a young philosopher who had adopted a wolf cub, which is a really stupid thing to do. But that intrigued me. And so it was all about this young academic, which obviously I can relate to, and a philosopher, and I'm interested in philosophy, raising a wolf, and I love dogs and that sort of thing. And so the story was engaging, and that for me was the sort of ear horn, because as this story progressed, he got into this issue a little bit when he was talking about his own transition towards not eating meat. And, you know, mentioned another book he had written that more directly addressed it. And by the time I was finished reading Philosopher and the Wolf, it's like I had gone, you know, in for a dime, in for a dollar. I was in for a dime by then. It took me 40 years to get in for a dime. But once that happened, then I kind of lifted the veil and looked behind a little bit and went, oh, my, you know, something's got to change here.
Great. Well, I hope this conversation gives you something of a spark to to other people, to undergraduates at UBC and my friends and the like. So if you have more time, Professor, I was just wondering if we could maybe go through some of the arguments that I heard from people around me for their own meat consumption, see whether or not you can maybe convince them to rethink those. So the main thing I got was essentially animals are subhuman. They have no purpose, this is the argument, other than to satisfy our own sort of instinctual desires to eat meat. We shouldn't think of them as equals. What do you say to this sort of argument?
Well, they have no purpose is kind of arrogant, I guess, but that aside, to just take it at the intellectual level, they're not equal. I definitely wouldn't say they're equal. I wouldn't say they're worse either. I would say obviously they're very different forms of life, as are each one of us to the other, you know, in the human species. Mm-hmm. We're all kind of different in our own ways. But the important, so then the question becomes, if you're going to be making ethical distinctions or drawing ethical distinctions such that, you know, we'll have one set of behaviors we consider okay for one species, let's say humans, and another set that are okay for the rest, as we usually do, those ethical distinctions should be based on something. There should be some characteristic that we believe is true of humans and false of all other life forms. And science has not been able to find any such characteristic. And if you start to even think, well, what would be a characteristic that's relevant? Well, the one thing that sort of makes sense that to anybody is the ability to feel pain and suffering. That if an organism can't feel any pain and suffering, well, then I guess it's okay to do nasty things to them because they don't know. Yeah. But if they can feel it, and there's every reason or no clear evidence that they're not feeling it the way we are, then, you know, where is the ethical justification? And there has to be something you can point to. You can't just say we're better than they are. There needs, you know, that's the whole idea of rational critical thought. There needs to be something you can point to.
Yeah. What about some of the sort of utilitarian arguments about using animals as protein and as a key source of nutrients? Do you think that argument in today's food system still holds weight?
Yeah, so that's one of the interesting aspects of this argument is I do like to keep it in the present, in the sense that, you know, people can argue and they can look back and they can make some pretty good arguments sometimes about the necessity to eat meat at various points. And in fact, I'm even, as I talk to different people about this, I'm absolutely sure I'm against factory farming. Not all meat comes from factory farms. Some meat comes from more traditional farms, and people can even make claims that these traditional farms, in a sense, it's like a contract with the animal. The animal gets enhanced quality of life, you know, free food, room and board, whatever, nice place to roam, for a limited period of time, and then, you know, then we eat them. But in a sense, they lived better than they would have in nature for a while, just didn't live as long. And so those arguments are kind of interesting and could be made. And that's what agriculture was for many years. But now with the invent of factory farming and this notion of mass production and saving every penny you can make, and it doesn't matter what pain and suffering and what health issues it raises and what environmental issues, that's where things have really kind of gone awry. So personally, I'm relatively extreme on the view in saying that, you know, we don't need to be eating any meat at all to survive just fine. I've made it a couple of years anyway, I don't know, but many vegetarians have made it much longer. There's all sorts of alternate forms of protein available now, and nutrients and all that kind of stuff. So nowadays you need not do it, and it's not even the case that it's more expensive to live vegetarian. I think there are many studies out there showing that you can live roughly for the same amount of money either way. It may be more of a pain in the butt to be vegetarian in the sense of having to seek out these alternate food sources because the meat market is so ubiquitous that it's literally, you know, very easy to stop anywhere and pick up some meat. So that distinction is there. But as far as actual nutritional value, it's not the case. And in fact, as far as health in general, if that's what we're thinking about, the two major causes of death in humans now is heart disease and cancer, both of which have very strong links to eating meat. So if you get your nutrition through non-meat sources, your protein and your nutrition, you will actually, by all the data we have, live longer and better than if you do it through meat.
Another argument I encountered was something of a resistance to vegetarianism, some sort of yucky trend, and that there's essentially, there is an instinctual desire, there is an evolutionary propensity to eat meat in humans. We are carnivores, so why should this change my opinion all of a sudden?
Yeah, I have a really funny twist on that, which I think makes a lot of sense, but it makes people scratch their heads a little bit. When you go into a lot of this debate, I make arguments that are kind of like, well, humans seem to think they are better than other species or more important or in some ways special, but I actually want them to be special. And what I mean by that is, yeah, it's absolutely natural for humans to eat meat. It's evolutionarily, you know, sort of built into our system, although not eating at the rate we did in back in, as I joke with my students, back in the day, where I mean like cave days, the meat they had access to was far rarer, and they did not have meat every day by any means. So it's not the case that we've been evolved to eat meat at the quantities, and fat especially. Look at the obesity epidemic. Our bodies were not evolved to eat it at the rate that people eat it nowadays, far less. But it is still natural for a more powerful species to dominate a weaker one. And so what I'm essentially saying is what I would like to see humans do is become unnatural, to actually be better, in a sense, than other species, in the sense of actually realizing the long-term implications of the behavior, not just the short-term ones. So most species look at short-term. What do I need now? And, of course, the claim that I make in the talk with respect to meat eating is that it does very little for us now. Meat tastes good. That's the only pro to eating meat. It tastes good. So it gives you that, a little bit of, you know, pleasant sensation. But you're ruining the environment. You're ruining your health. You're contributing to intentional pain and suffering. And the list does, you know, continue about the negative long-term implications of continuing as we're doing. And so humans are unique in the sense that they're able to look at long-term implications and not just short-term implications. And that's somewhat unnatural, but I think that's okay. And I think slavery is absolutely the best example of that. I mean, why, by that argument, should not one species or one country or one type of person dominate another? By evolutionary arguments, if they can, that's natural. But at some point in our history, we said, it may be natural, but it's not right. And it's not good for our... And I think more and more we're all realizing we need a more healthy interaction with the environment around us and the animals we share it with. And that's what I kind of push. This is a move towards a more respectful interaction with the planet, one that will ultimately pay off generations down the road.
Great. So just last question, Professor. Those are the arguments. What do you suggest as ways to convince people, ways to get that William James moment out of more people, to re-examine their views?
Yeah, this has become sort of a challenge. In fact, all of this, as I become more interested in this and started to voice my opinion and then keep my ears open for counters, I've wrestled with that question more and more because I run into a lot of vegetarian groups and blogs and such where there's a real fatalistic aspect where literally they talk about almost the evil meat eaters and how they will never change. And, you know, there's really this kind of notion which I find a little disempowering, and I instead prefer to think, well, how can you do that? And one of my inspirations, actually, for the talk was, funny, in a weird way, Mark Rowlands, in that book, The Philosopher and the Wolf, he's similarly lamenting, like people on these websites, and he's going through a period of his life where he doesn't like apes because the ape brain, and that includes humans, by the way, the ape brain has evolved to a point where we can deceive very well, and we've learned how to do all this with our, you know, enhanced consciousness, trick other people and lie and cheat and etc., which he compares to wolves, which he claims cannot do these things. They do not have as developed a consciousness. They're much more honest, living in the moment. And his reaction to that is, so I'm going to withdraw from all humans, become a misanthrope, and just hang out with my dogs and wolves. Mm-hmm. And my reaction when I read that is, no, I don't think that's how I want to go with this. I think how I want to go is I want to be an eight. I want to take those skills I have and try to use them. So you'll realize in the talk is entitled Critical Thinking. It's sort of about critical thinking, and it is. But what I try to do is use my little ape-like powers to pull a fast one on people, open their minds, make them open to the ideas I'm suggesting of critical analysis, all this, and then introduce this issue that I would really like them to think about and that they would probably normally avoid thinking about. And so, you know, I'm an extreme in the sense of I condone using trickery under the right, sneaky trickery under the right pretense. In this sort of situation, simply because the alternative seems to be a lot of people who are pushing the emotionality. So if you watch the meat thing, that's what most people will throw at you right off the bat, and they'll describe all those processes in detail. And I prefer not to do that because that emotionality just makes us all. It sends the message that humans are evil, and I don't think that's the right message. I think humans have done some remarkably good things, but every now and then we just don't think about things well enough. And I'm firmly convinced that if we think about it, we have the capacity to do the right things, and truly, in fact, exceptional things, like getting rid of slavery and, I like to think, shutting down factory farms. So I prefer to appeal to the intellect and to keep the emotion out of it. And I kind of hope that's the way forward. But I would say, you know, ask me in 5 years and see if I've made any progress.
Great. Well, Professor, I'd really like to thank you for joining me today. I thought it was really informative. And we'll post the talk up on the website. Hopefully everyone will be as interested as I am.
Yeah, cool. That's great. And by the way, if they watch any of those talks and vote before Sunday, I don't know when this will be up there, but they have a chance to win a ridiculous prize package. So.
Oh, wow. I had no idea the voting was still up. I'll definitely post the link up to the lecture as well, and hope you win. Good luck.
Cool.
Thanks a lot, Professor.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah.